and the signal you get back from it get weaker and weaker by a very predictable amount. The satellite was designed in such a way that you change the data rate. As you get further and further away and the signal in each direction gets weaker, instead of sending the data at, let me pick a number, 100 kilobits per second, you send it at 3 bits per second. If you slow down the data and you use the right kind of receiver processing on both ends, you can tolerate a weaker and weaker signal. It's hard to believe. And so they are doing that. The data rate is getting very slow because the original 10-watt traveling wave tube transmitter, I think, is down to 5 watts of power output. We've had a lot of years on that particular tube. I'm amazed that that tube filament has survived that long. So, in fact, whenever you give it a command to reorient itself or whatever, you give it a command to do something where it might make a mistake. Let me drop. Where it might make a mistake and steer its dish away from Earth, and you'll never talk to it again. If that high-gain dish on Voyager is not aimed at Earth, game over. You'll never talk to Earth again, even though you're using a zillion-watt transmitter on a 240-foot diameter dish at Goldstone, California. The most amount of steam you can generate, if you know what I mean. That's a long distance out there, lots of billions of miles, and that signal gets weak. What's that again, Paul?
They have a backup. They got these saw trackers. If it loses direction, you know, over time, it, you know, a certain amount of time, it'll reorient itself and point the antenna back to Earth. The same with Cassini and all these other spacecraft.
Okay, so there is a recovery mode. But when it comes to the major commands you give the system, what they do quite frequently is setting up a whole series of commands that, hey, reload this new program. But don't do it yet. Put it in the cache memory, the standby memory. Read back that cache memory. Tell me what you heard. Those are the commands you give to that satellite in many cases. You give it a whole bunch of new commands. You then say, don't do it yet. Send that back to me. Tell me what you heard. The signal comes back down to the Earth. You study every bit and you say, aha, it got it correctly. Then you send up the message, all right, you got it correct, go do it. And because you've got 15 and a half hours one way at the speed of light, 31 or 32 hours round trip, and you've got to do that 32 hours twice, not counting the amount of time where you check the message, as you can see, giving it a major command, a new program, so to speak, which I think they did do on some of these missions. After launch, they came up with better video compression techniques where less bits of data would give them at least the same, if not higher, resolution of the picture being sent down. On some of these satellites, after launch, they gave it a brand new program to tell it how to compress the data before sending it back. And again, you got to make sure it does it right, otherwise you could really get yourself in trouble. Tell me what you heard. Do you hear me now? I wonder if that makes sense, Paul. I wonder if you heard things along those lines. WS2N, K2RIW?
Oh, yeah. I've heard they've sent out completely different programs decades ago by for the Voyager. They sent out different, everything different. But, yeah. Oh, by the way, they do still send commands to Voyager to reorient itself, take measurements, and then turn back. It's still going on today. Right now they're experimenting. They're trying to figure out where the heliosphere ends. That's where the influence of the sun and the galactic space, you know, ends. And that's what they're trying to figure out where that is. So really, that would be the official end of the solar system. I mean, you know, there is an Oort cloud to contend with, but you know, the real influence is they consider the heliosphere. So they're looking for that. Both Voyager 1 and 2. 2 is, I think, closer to it. So they reoriented and then take measurements where the cosmic rays are coming from, and then turns back to Earth and then transmits the information.
In any of the things that you've heard about Voyager, Paul, do you remember reading what they've gone down to in bit rate? Are they down to transmitting the data at 5 or 10 bits per second because the signal is getting so weak? Have you heard anything along those lines? Over to you, Paul, K2RIW.
No, Dick. I rely on you with for that information. I remember you telling me a while back what they were probably down to, but I know it's decreased. But you know what has helped is they've built better receivers on this end and transmitters. So you know, I mean, they never designed it. They never thought they would have the capability. I don't know how many dB we're up to, you know, compared to what they were when they launched back in 77. The deep space network is what tracks these things, and they've improved so much. So I guess that helps it from the bit rate dropping down to zero.
WHYY. Joe recognized. Yeah, the uplink, you still got a finite amount of transmit power, a finite amount of dish size, finite amount of effective isotropic radiated power, leaving the Earth, going to Voyager, and you can't redesign the front end. But the signal that you get back down, yes, continuous improvements are going on at the NASA. It's called the Mars Station, the 240-foot Goldstone dish, and I visited that dish. And Fort Irwin is where it's located in the Mojave Desert. The Mojave Desert is the Goldstone system. I visited them at midnight one night and talked to the guys that were on staff at that particular time. I took my camera out and tried taking a time-lapse photograph, but the camera, the particular inexpensive camera I had, wasn't capable of doing it. So I didn't get a picture of the dish while I was standing under it at nighttime. Beautiful-looking piece of hardware. And one of the things they've done is to replace the signal that goes to the feed horn is now beam waveguide. In other words, there is no waveguide, there is no transmission line that goes between the transmitter and the feed horn for this Cassegrain dish system. It's called beam waveguide. In other words, there's the equivalent of a small parabolic dish launching the signal that goes through various mirrors that allow you to go through what you and I would call the rotary joint for elevation and azimuth, right ascension, declination, but they do call it elevation and azimuth. It is an elevation over azimuth mounting system on the Goldstone dish, and that signal is sent up as a very wide beam of energy to the equivalent of the feed horn, very similar to the periscope antenna system that we used to see, where there's a dish on the ground alongside of the tower aimed straight up, and you got a 45-degree fly swatter on the top of the tower that redirects the signal out to the horizon. Those are very efficient antenna systems. And so the equivalent of that waveguide going up the tower can have a small fraction of a dB of loss as opposed to many dB of loss. In some cases, you actually get gain out of that system. That's another whole crazy story how that happens. So W-H-Y-Y, K-Q-R-I-W. Go ahead, Joe.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but if I'm right on this, the theoretical bandwidth, the theoretical noise floor for a 1 hertz signal, taking other factors out of the equation, is something like minus 174 dBm for a bandwidth of 1 hertz. I believe that's correct. What would you think, even taking other factors into consideration, that the noise floor is of the receiving apparatus on these spacecraft? What do you think they can ultimately go down to as far as a finite number, and that's it?
First of all, one of the things that's really amazing is that the signal doesn't get tired, even though the number of miles out to voyage is a huge number, 116 astronomical units, 116 times 93 million miles, and you can easily calculate a 5-watt signal into, I don't know the exact number, maybe it's a 4-foot diameter dish on Voyager, 5-foot diameter dish, sending the signal back to Earth. You know the dish gain, you know the power output, you know how much signal you're going to get down here. And by the way, the minus 114 dBm per megacycle is 174 dBm per hertz, that's correct, but that is KTB of 290 Kelvin, that's room temperature. If you've got a cryogenic system, you can do a hell of a lot better than that. So they don't use dBm per hertz. They use dBm per hertz per degree Kelvin. So when I go from 300 degrees Kelvin, that's another 25 dB. I think the number comes out minus 205. I can work that one out, but I believe it's minus 205 dBm per hertz per degree Kelvin is noise temperature. And so because they've got a cryogenically cooled front end, a hell of a lot better than room temperature. It's a lot quieter, and they're looking at a cold part of the sky. You find the limiting temperature of a system, a real sensitive radio telescope. Let me drop. Your final limit is the Penzias-Wilson measurement. The sky is 2.73 degrees Kelvin. In other words, the amount of thermal energy scattered across that universe is a uniform cloud of, let me round it off, 3 degrees Kelvin, left over from the Big Bang. So no matter how quiet you make your cryogenic front end, you could, in theory, design a cryogenic front end that's 1 degree Kelvin. Maybe it's a parametric amplifier that's cryogenically cooled. And you could build a dish that has very good control of the side lobes and high efficiency because of beam waveguide techniques and whatever. You can make the antenna temperature a very low number, where ordinarily the back lobes of the antenna looking at hot Earth is one of the main sources of thermal energy getting into your antenna. And with good design practices, you can lower that. But eventually you get down to the fact that the sky itself is 3 degrees Kelvin. And you're not going to get below that one. We can't find a colder universe than the one that we live in, if you know what I mean. So if someone told me that at 1 hertz of bit rate, they can listen to a signal of minus 180 dBm, I think I would believe it. And we can work out the mathematics of that, but it becomes an extremely weak signal. And we can calculate exactly how strong that signal is going to be, 116 astronomical units out, 5 watts into a 5-foot dish. That's all fairly easy back-of-the-envelope stuff if you've done ground station calculations, Joe. So there isn't too much rocket science to that one, if you know what I mean. It's a little bit unusual for the average ham to go there, but for those who have, it's not too heavy. WHYY, KQRYW.
I just thought I'd ask a question because I'm curious, like probably other people. And glad to have you on here as a an answer source somewhat. But it just made me think about that because after a while, the signal, yes, it's going to become weaker and weaker and weaker. And what's going to give out first? Your nuclear power supply that's supplying power? Or are you going to get to a point where you simply can't receive Earth anymore? WS2N, I have an answer for that there.
Yeah, what you're really asking is the uplink or the downlink that's going to fail first? Go ahead, Paul.
I have a question also, Dick.
Brian, John reckons
the predicted failure is in the thermocouples. The dissimilar metals will eventually fail.
I think you're saying that the electrical power output of the thermal generator, the thermal electric generator, what were the words that we used for that? The snap generator. You're saying that its electrical power output is continuously decreasing, and that's why the tube is putting out 5 watts these days instead of 10 watts? Over to you, Paul.
Yeah, that's what I've read. In other words, you have, well, the thermocouples are two dissimilar metals. You got a whole bunch of these things in the thermal blankets, and that's what's heating up. And these things, the point-to-point contact, whatever, you know, I've never seen a close-up view of them, but the metals will eventually degrade between the two, you know, the points of the metal, so that's going to be the thing that will kill it. Power to plutonium is going to go on, you know, for another 100 years. But now originally I heard up to 2019 was the predicted date, and then anything after that is going to be gravy. So we'll be hearing from this thing for another at least eight years, I hope, Dick.
Wow, 2019, and that's the predicted failure rate. Because of uplink, downlink, thermocouple failure, tube failure. In other words, the rate at which you're getting electrical energy out of those thermocouples of that nuclear power supply, I think you're saying that that's going to fall below a threshold where the transmitter no longer works, and that's 2019, that's the prediction. Is that roughly it, Paul? Go ahead.
Yeah. I got one of Carl Sagan's books. That's the earliest there. How many years ago he predicted that? He's been dead since 1996. So you know, he predicted that. He worked very closely with those missions, as you probably know. So he was up on that. One of his books, I'll find out which one, I have them all. He makes that statement about the thermocouples eventually failing. But he also gives the predicted date, like I said, another 8 years from now.
And by the way, if somebody ever asks you what's the weakest signal that mankind can ever receive, I remember that me and W81MBA, my mind's going blank, can't think of his name all of a sudden. Anyhow, Tom Williams, Dr. Tom Williams and I, one day were sending emails back and forth saying, okay, could I take a 1 milliwatt transmitter on the moon and transmit a signal back to Earth that can be received? Or could I use a 1 milliwatt transmitter on the Earth and send a moonbound signal with a very simple antenna? If I really go to extremely small bit rates and use radiometry techniques, we get down to 1 photon per second of RF energy coming back to the moon from the moon. Could you send a signal that weak and get information and send your call letters or whatever? And if so, what signal strength? And I think we came to the conclusion that one photon per second, which is about the smallest I think we could measure, which, by the way, the European Southern Observatory is measuring something like 1 photon per second when they're measuring the reflected energy from Halley's Comet when it's out at the aphelion. It's at the furthest part from the sun right now, and it's an object as black as coal, and we're using their great big optical telescopes. They integrate for days on end in order to see, to get a picture of Halley's Comet at its maximum orbit. And I think they're down to something like 1 photon per second. So that comes out to be something like -205 dBm. John, KC2WGB, what's the weakest signal you've ever listened to? K2LAW in the TechNet.
I think the one that just fell out of my brain when I was listening to you talk about the universe in general. We know the volume of the foreseeable universe. I wonder if anybody has actually calculated the amount of BTUs from the Big Bang to cause this temperature to be 3 degrees above Kelvin. Had to be some number.
And that question, I know where you're going with this one, Paul. I'm going to give you a partial answer. You'd be amazed how many times in life.
I'm amazed.
What was that again, Paul?
That was John, not me.
I said Paul, but I meant John. Sorry about that. John, this is one of those cases where knowing orders of magnitude is the main thing you want to know about. If you and I were camping out in the woods, John, and we ran into a grizzly bear, and he's coming toward you, and you and I are doing the best we can to stay alive, and so we're scattering in some other direction and hiding behind a tree or doing whatever, in that particular situation, whether that grizzly bear weighs 400 pounds, 600 pounds, or 800 pounds, doesn't matter. All you know is that some big, fierce animal is coming toward you with claws slashing, and he's growling, and he views you as a meal inside of some cloth clothing. All he's got to do is peel off the cloth clothing, and he's got the meal. You know, a polar bear looks at you and me that way, and a grizzly bear looks at you and me that way. So you don't have to know the weight. All you have to know is, he's damn big and damn heavy, and I better be moving in the other direction. By the same token, when it comes to what was the temperature of the Big Bang, rough order of magnitude gets you into the ballpark. I know that at 1,300 watts per square meter that I measure of solar energy in my backyard at high noon, and I know how far the sun is away, I can figure out that the sun is putting out approximately 10 to the 27 watts. That's how many watts the sun is putting out continuously, 24/7, one with 27 zeros, and I might be one zero too many or one zero too few, somewhere between 10 to the 26 and 10 to the 28, close enough, and I can calculate how much energy the sun's going to put out in its whole 10 billion year lifetime. By way of the Penzias-Wilson experiment, you know what the temperature of the sky is in all directions, and for a whole bunch of reasons, we think the universe is 13.7 billion years old. You know the rate at which it's cooling off. It's an exponential decay. And so you can work it backwards, and you get a...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
You get a little bit of ambiguity when it comes to calculating how long was the instant of the Big Bang. I've seen these these science write-ups where they talk about what happened in the first 10 to the minus 34 seconds. And I look at that and I say, somebody ain't realistic. At the speed of light is 1 nanosecond per foot. In 1 nanosecond, light gets 1 foot. That's 12 inches. That's 100 picoseconds per inch. It's 10 picoseconds per tenth of an inch, and so on. So when you get to 10 to the minus 10 seconds, we're talking about 1 inch. If we get down to 10 to the minus 11 seconds, we're talking about a tenth of an inch. So to talk about 10 to the minus 34 seconds, which means you're talking about, at the speed of light, you're way, way inside of the nucleus of a single atom. To talk about time in those kind of units, as they sometimes do in those write-ups, I might be wrong, but I laugh at that, because at the speed of light, that represents an amount of distance that's ridiculous. That amount of material of the Big Bang was not inside of one atom, in my opinion. Just don't believe that. So if you talk about what happens in the first microsecond, I'm going to keep reading. You talk about what happens in the first 10 to the minus 31 seconds, and somebody is, gone too many orders of magnitude beyond reality. So I guarantee that that temperature was really big. And was there really one Big Bang? Stand by. I'm convinced, absolutely not. For there to be one Big Bang, for there to be only one universe, and we just happen to be in the middle of this particular universe, and that what we can see optically, 13.7 billion light years, we can see in any one direction with a real good telescope like Hubble. But then you take the ultra-deep field picture with Hubble where you integrate for a million seconds, and you get this picture that's got 2,600 galaxies that have never been seen before, in that tiny little small fraction of 1 degree where you looked in one particular direction where you thought there was going to be nothing. It's a dark section of the sky. And you look in that direction, and you see a whole bunch of stuff you've never seen before. I'm led to believe that you use a bigger and bigger telescope and longer integration time and more sensitive photo detectors, you're going to see a whole lot of stuff. And the word observable universe, I mean, do we suddenly believe that since the density of stuff out there, the perimeter of what you and I can observe, doesn't change? In other words, there's almost as much stuff out there as in here. It isn't suddenly getting very sparse out there. There's a whole lot of stuff out there. What you and I call the universe is a hell of a lot bigger than what we've seen. And we still think there's only one of them? Why in the world should there be only one? And you've heard me say, I'm speculating over and over again, that the dark energy is really the stuff being sucked over the edge into the next galaxy that we don't see. That's why the stuff is expanding out there and accelerating. I just don't think there is a repulsive force that has that long a range of operation. I think almost everything is attractive at that longer range, and gravity is what does it. That's a guess on my part, a bunch of guesses. So you and I could estimate the approximate temperature in the first microsecond, as I see it there, John, and we'd come up with a great big number. And maybe the number is 10 to the 15 degrees Kelvin.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
And you and I could write that article, and somebody would say, whoa, you guys are wrong. You forgot this factor and you forgot that factor. It's really 10 to the 16. Doesn't matter. When the number is that big, all you know is it's huge. It reminds me of some of the earlier societies that used to count 1, 2, 3, many. KC2WGB. What's the biggest number you know of, John? K2RIW in the TechNet.
1, 2, 3, 4, and another. I believe in your time scale, Dick, because the contemporary view right now is at the point that this Big Bang happened, which they are saying this was a pinpoint, hard to believe, the first thing that was formed were the quarks. And the quarks combined to do the production of the protons and neutrons, and it went from there. But for that to all happen within a couple of thousandths of an inch, at the rate it did, is just incomprehensible. But that's what they're thinking, and that's where they're going with it. But I was just wondering, that temperature had to be something that we can't even imagine. Even when you look at the sun, the interior temperature, or the photosphere, or the surface, but they're nowhere near as hot as that had to be. So I just thought I'd ask.
Yeah, the amount of mass you can get in a supermassive black hole is really a big number. You're talking about a million solar masses are some of these black holes in the center of some of these galaxies. Wild. 10 million solar masses. To me, the sun is very big, very heavy. Can you imagine 10 million of them all compressed into one dot, so to speak? It's kind of hard to believe. So these big numbers, you got to treat them exponentially. The biggest real number, I mean, you can come up with crazy numbers when it comes to all the possible permutations and combinations of something. You're talking about statistics. But a real number, I remember this article that was in the front end of the book explaining how to use your Hewlett-Packard 28S calculator. The Hewlett-Packard 28S, the biggest number it can tolerate is 10 to the 230 power. My Hewlett-Packard 50 calculator can go to 10 to the 450 power. Is 10 to the 450 power a real number? Let me give you another paragraph on that one. The smallest real thing that you and I know about as a real object is probably an electron. Yeah, we can talk about the subparticles, but no one's ever seen a isolated quark. So maybe it doesn't really exist unless they're in combinations that make protons and neutrons. So an electron, I forget what the number was, I think it was 10 to the minus 31 meters is the diameter. So if I take electrons, which is the smallest thing I know about, I can calculate their volume. I know approximately what the observable universe is. It's a sphere 13.7 billion light years in radius in all directions. So that's the biggest thing I can think of, the whole darn universe that's observable. And the smallest thing that's real that I know about is an electron. And if I pack electrons as tight as I possibly can, somebody has given me a great big bag of electrons, a very big bag of electrons, and I completely fill up every single space in the observable universe with electrons. That number comes out 10 to the 131 power. I can't think of anything real that's smaller. I can't think of anything real that's bigger. And if I take the smallest thing and pack them as tight as I can into the biggest thing, that's about the biggest real number I can get. It's a solid sphere of electrons at a universal size. 10 to the 131 power. So therefore, when my little old handheld calculator goes to 10 to the 250 power, that's a umpty-ump zillion universes packed with electrons as tight as you can get. And my new calculator goes 10 to the 450 power. The reason they did that is because there's a kind of a round-off error you get when it comes to matrix inversion of complex numbers. So to make the mathematics work out right, they gave you a much bigger exponent. But is anything you and I calculate really...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Is anything you and I really calculate really going to go there? No. The most number of decimal places of anything that I know about that mankind really measures is time or frequency. National Bureau of Standards tells you what frequency accuracy they're transmitting to 14 decimal places. That's a real measurement, frequency or time, 14 decimal places. When it comes to, I think it's Planck's constant or whatever, I think I've seen it written out to 18 or so decimal places. But I'm a little bit skeptical, is that a real measurement? Because for that to really be a measurement, I think we're getting down to accuracies that are way beyond subatomic sizes in smallness, if you know what I mean. KC2WGB, I bet you got a real question this weekend, John. K2LAW in the TechNet.
That's all right. I thought Planck's constant was 10 to the minus 27, but I'm probably wrong. But I've been playing with my Wimhurst machine, and I did some of the experiments that you and I were talking about.
I think that would be kind of interesting. What John has done is he's bought himself a Wimhurst machine, which has got approximately 10-inch diameter of its rotary discs. It's a clear plastic disc with these metallic spokes, and I think he told me he got 3 inches. What was that now? I forgot what that was in millimeters. You gave it to me. As to the spark gap, and I was telling you how to reset the shorting bars so you can possibly get a little bit more, particularly when you aim the positive probe toward the negative probe, and you find out real fast whether or not you guessed as to which one was positive or negative, and you can confirm it with a flame. You can also confirm it by just the way it behaves. When you aim the negative probe toward the positive, it sizzles real fast, and you never get a real spark, you never get high voltage. Do it the other way around, and he possibly has gotten beyond 3 inches of gap, which means he's getting into the 150, maybe even 200 kilovolts of voltage generated on this very simple machine by just turning the crank and watching the sparks. And one of the things you're eventually going to do is get a hold of this Volter's Hailstorm toy I'll tell you about. But give us a few words on what your Wimshurst machine has done so far, John. KC2WGV, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGV. Okay, first I tried my neodymium magnets, and I thought it would deflect the arc. It did not, and I used 10 of those quarter-sized magnets stacked together. Had a very strong field. No effect at all. Another thing I did, I tried the flame test with butane, methane, and propane. All of them acted the same. As you started the crank, the vertical flame would start leaning toward the arc area. And as soon as it snapped, it would jump back. And as it built up, it would pull again. All three gas flames did that, by the way, Dick.
Now, I presume what you're doing is adjusting the flame so it's sitting out in front of the gap region, and now the flame bends itself toward the gap. One of the stories I read somewhere, and I haven't done this one yet, said that if you had a candle flame, and the candle flame was wrapped almost around, I think it was the positive terminal, but maybe it was the negative, that the flame would behave even before the zap occurred. There would be a kind of local wind that would be blowing the flame away. You got an attraction of the flame, not a repulsion. Interesting. Now, the flame itself is a plasma material. It's an electronically conducting material. So I guess those early leader strokes that are about to make a spark somehow sense the fact that there's a local conducting medium nearby, the plasma of your flame. And I think you're saying the flame would lean toward it. In other words, you set the flame out in front of the air gap and it leaned toward it. Is that approximately it, John? KC2WGV, K2RIW?
Yes, I had the flame out approximately, I'd say, 75 millimeters from the center of the arc point, pointing directly up toward the ceiling. And as soon as I started to crank, the flame would react. And then when it sparked, when it discharged, it would snap vertically again, and it worked perfectly. Also, I took my compass, and it was an oil-filled compass, and I placed it on the crossbar that supports the two arcing elements, and I cranked it. And it'll move your compass 5 degrees as you start to come up. And as soon as it snaps, you'll see it go back and forth. Interesting.
Now, tell me what you mean by the crossbar that supports the two probes, or whatever that was. Where did you mount the compass? I'm having trouble picturing that one, John. Go ahead.
Okay, Dick, the two arc arms that you adjust that have the polystyrene handles on them, you set that up for your gap, whatever it is. Now, the bar, the clear plastic, it looks like almost like celluloid, but it's probably something else, that runs horizontally, that actually holds those arc bars. That's where I rested the compass on. So it was, I would say, maybe 100 millimeters toward the wheel from the arc itself. And the arc was taking place around maybe 5-6 inches above the compass itself. So the radial distance from the compass was probably like 8 inches.
Yeah, each of these Wimshurst machines has different methods of construction. If you go to Amazon.com and you put in a search word, Wimshurst, W-I-M-S-H-U-R-S-T, you'll see various vendors selling these machines starting at around $59 and going to a couple hundred dollars, depending on how much quality. And I think you bought one of the higher quality ones. Your particular method of construction has a plastic rod or a plastic platform of a kind going between the two high-voltage probes. My particular machine, each individual Leyden jar is the mechanical support for the high-voltage pickup brushes as well as the probe itself, the spark gap device. It's all suspended from a mechanically strong Leyden jar. So it's a different method of construction. As such, I don't have your particular platform. However, one of the things you're eventually going to want to do what I did was to go out and get some 2 pounds per cubic foot building foam, but the insulating foam you can buy at a good supply house that supplies materials for house construction.
Yeah, it's extruded foam.
That stuff comes up, used to be blue, nowadays it's green, and you can buy it 1-inch thick, 2-inch thick, and 4-inch thick. And you buy a couple of sheets of that and cut it up into blocks. You now have these very simple support mechanisms by which you can suspend things, and they are very non-conductive, very low in density. They don't disturb anything, if you know what I mean. So you can support things at various altitudes on those, and I use them to support, for instance, the Volta's hailstorm. You go to Science First and you use a search word, Volta's hailstorm. You'll find this device that really looks like a 3-inch or so diameter plastic tube, clear plastic tube that's about 4 inches tall, and it's got a metal plate on the top and the bottom and a stand below and a great big probe on the top of it. And inside of that tube, they put these very small pitfalls. Let me drop. And when you put high voltage between the upper plate and the lower plate, when the conductivity of the pith balls is just right and you shine a bright light on them, you get an extremely exciting display of these pith balls, and we're talking about a couple of hundred of them jumping up and down as fast as they can go. My goodness, are they busy. But there's a catch. If you've got a super dry day and you think that the high voltage is really going to behave correctly, as far as the high voltage coming out of your wind source machine, that's correct. But the pith balls themselves, if you've got extremely low humidity, each individual pith ball is a small piece of plastic, foamed plastic, which can easily develop a differential charge across each individual pith ball. The bottom line is that the pith balls will sit on the bottom. Some of them don't move. Some of them jump up halfway, stick to the plastic on the side, and refuse to move. You pour one or two drops of alcohol into the machine, into the Volta's pitfall, Volta's hailstorm thing. You open up the top cap, pour one or two drops of alcohol in there, and close it, and wait a couple of seconds for it to spread around. It makes the pitfalls just conductive enough that they become extremely active, but you got to be careful. You put in one more drop, thinking you're going to get more action. Now everything inside of the Volta's hailstorm device becomes so conductive that it becomes a short circuit to your wind source machine, and you don't develop a high voltage anymore. So there's a very delicate balance required there. That's one of the many toys that you can use with this machine. I wonder what kind of toys you've seen before. You may have seen this device where you can make the bell clank back and forth between two conductors. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
KC2WGB. One thing I was going to try is take a styrofoam cup. As you know, it's made up of little beads. Break it apart physically and put a couple of those inside of the test tube. And I didn't get to do that yet. But one thing I did, which proves you were right about pointed arc rods versus the ball type. What I did was I took some steel wool and I pulled off a piece and was very thin, maybe a millimeter, millimeter and a half. I squashed it down the size of a nickel and I placed that on one of the electrodes. Only one. I made a little tiny hole in the middle and slipped it over that small ball so it was sitting on the larger ball. You could crank that machine all night, it will not arc. Isn't that unbelievable?
I believe that, and you'll get a very different response if you put it on the negative lead versus the positive lead. Do you have reason to know which one you put it on, John? I think you would still build up some voltage on the positive lead. On the negative lead, it's going to kill everything. Over to you, John.
It didn't matter. Either one I put it on, it would not build up an arc. I could hear it start to build up, but it would never flash over. Amazing. And another thing I did, I have a plastic engineer's rule. It's approximately 2 inches wide, about maybe 14 inches long. And I think it's polystyrene. If I were to place that shorting the two elements, you cannot build up an arc either. But yet, if you put it next standing up, blocking one of them, it will arc through it. Isn't that something?
The next thing you're going to calculate is what kind of a load can the machine tolerate. The machine is capable of putting out... The machine is capable of putting out probably at least 100 kilovolts, if not more. And I think it can put out a couple of microamperes. You calculate what is the feminine impedance of the machine, 100 kilovolts and 10 microamperes, and you rapidly come up with 10 to the 11 ohms. In other words, if you put a 10 to the 11 ohm or 10 to the 12 ohm resistor between the two, in theory, it would only produce half the voltage. So you can see how when it comes to high-potting, you and I, if we high-pot something, we come up with an answer of 10 megohms. We say, hey, that's essentially an open circuit. To this machine, 10 megohms, which is 10 to the 7 ohms, is almost a dead short circuit. This thing wants to see 10 to the 11 or 10 to the 12 ohms. So you got to make sure that whatever piece of plastic you put across those high-voltage probes has no moisture, no fingerprints, and is made out of very highly resistive material, because 10 to the 11 ohms is a significant resistor, a significant load. That's the first time I've ever worked with those kind of voltages. And to try to make a voltage divider that would be successful with this machine without loading it down, wow, that ain't easy. I think perfectly denatured, no, what's what I'm looking for, perfectly distilled...
isopropyl?
Perfectly distilled deionized water in a piece of vinyl tubing. Whether or not that can have a high enough resistance to act as a load resistor, I don't know yet. Someday I'm going to run some experiments along those lines. Over to you, John, K2RIW.
I haven't received my thermometer that I put in. I can't wait to get that, get some of those experiments running. Let me see, there was a few other things I did with it. Oh, by the way, I was able to get a 92-millimeter arc. I got it up to 92 millimeters by playing with it the way you said, trying different angles, and that worked out very nice.
Yeah, I live in the imperial, even though this is the metric world, I live in the imperial world, so I've got to figure out what that really means, and which is what I'm doing right now. I don't believe that. Let's try that again. 9.2 centimeters, 2.54 divide, nope, let's try that again.
Comes out to like 3 5/8, something like that, 3 1/4.
That's exactly my number. I get 3 5/8 inches. On a real good day, carefully tuned, the best I've ever done is 3 5/8 inches. 92 millimeters is 3.62 inches, very close to the same number. And if you operate it in a dark room in that mode, you'll find out the majority of the corona discharge is taking place across the spokes on each individual wheel. In other words, between the shorting bar, where you've tried to maximize the distance between the shorting bar and a pickup high-voltage cone, you'll see that in that area on the left side and the right side, you'll find out that the arcing between the metallic spokes that are on each disc is what's limiting. So the diameter of the disc determines the maximum voltage you can ever get out of the machine. That's why I'm in the process of building a machine with twice the diameter of those discs. And you got to be careful when you do that, because the total charge now in the Leyden jars is getting to a slightly dangerous level. Over to you, John, K2RIW.
A question I have for you, Dick, because you have your machine a lot longer than I do. When I've been cranking this machine, and I don't really crank it at very high speeds, I've noticed there's a flaking deposit coming down on the baseboard from something. Did you ever experience that?
My particular machine has metallic spokes with alternating paper spokes. And I presume the paper spokes are supposed to collect that material that you're describing. I know some of the designs have got all metallic spokes, and mine has alternating metallic and paper. And there's great big black streaks across the paper in between the metallic spokes where the shorting bars do the touching. The high voltage pickups are combs that do not make contact. They just come close. And at first your common sense would lead you to believe you're going to get more voltage if they made contact. And the answer is no. There's a magic distance of separation on the pickup high voltage combs that do not touch the spokes, but the shorting bars must touch the spokes. And so the total current that flows there is significant. And in my case, my shorting bar, let me drop. My shorting bar brushes look like they're made out of brass. The spokes themselves look like they're made out of aluminum sheet metal. And so now you've got these dissimilar materials of brass and aluminum and continuous sparking going on as each one comes in contact with the shorting bars. So I think that is what the material is. I think it's, I'm going to make a guess, it's aluminum oxide flakes that you're seeing building up on the base of the machine. And you said you ordered some extra toys or whatever, or extra apparatus to go with this, or run that by again. Over to you, John, K2RIW.
Yes, they have a material that's plastic. It's very similar to that magnetic viewer that you have and I have. You put a magnet near it, and it's a plastic film that responds. They have that, and they also have a tube, which I'm assuming must be some kind of a neon tube. They have that. I ordered that also. It has a specific name, which I don't remember. But a couple of toys like that I ordered. I want to play with that. And then I want to do some dark experiments, too. I haven't run it with the lights out yet because I was just getting familiar with the operation, trying to get the... I got to get a electrostatic voltmeter, too, that can handle this kind of voltage. That's the next thing I'm going to look for.
Yeah. Where do you think, what brand name and what type of electrostatic voltmeter do you think you might be able to procure, John? Go ahead.
I was looking at a Keithley. But in the voltage range that I need, it was over $1,000, so that's unacceptable to me. I think I can get some military surplus, probably, that'll do the job.
The Keithley instrument, the electrostatic voltmeter, how many volts did it go to? What did it look like? What is its readout procedure, John? Go ahead.
It's an analog meter. There's nothing digital about it at all. It measures 200,000 volts, but there was an asterisk on that and no explanation of what that meant. So maybe that was like beyond a certain percentage of accuracy. That's one thing I have to investigate.
Yeah, I keep forgetting the brand name of the one that I own, which was thrown away by a college. And I just happened to do a dumpster dive that particular day. What a lucky break this thing was. The machine I've got is approximately 1 cubic foot, black material, 1 cubic foot, and the whole face across the 1 cubic foot, one whole face has got this, what looks like a linear Dawson valve meter movement that is almost 12 inches wide, left to right, and about 2 inches high, and it's got about 5 scales to it, and depending on how you set the internal probe, coming out of the back of this thing, you've got a very high voltage insulator that's probably 10 inches long, probably 2 inches or 1.5 inches in diameter, and a whole bunch of ridges to it made out of brown porcelain. And coming out of the back of that is this rod that you can stick into 3 different click stops, which gives you the 3 different voltage ranges. So this electrostatic voltmeter, let me drop. It really works by electrostatic repulsion. Is it repulsion or attraction? Let me think about that.
Oh, it's a vein unit. Okay, it's repulsion.
I'm not sure if it's repulsion or attraction. One vein is grounded, and the great big probe that goes in there is the one that's got the voltage on it. So I think it would have to be attraction, John. I think it works by attraction, but it's a vein-type meter. And the highest scale it's got is 30 kilovolts. And I wish it would go to, 300 kilovolts. And... you know the way when you operate an electroscope, if you take a charged glass rod and you touch it to the electroscope, of course the leaf's electroscope will instantaneously pop out to the maximum deflection. But if you hold the glass rod near the electroscope, you can get any amount of deflection of those leaf's that you want. So by the same token, I think I'm going to run an experiment where I take the high voltage that I want to measure, don't directly connect it to the probe of the vein voltmeter, just put it near it, and if I choose the right spacing, I think I can get the equivalent of voltage multiplication. But measuring the voltage and watching that voltage increase and decay with certain experiments, that's kind of a fun experiment. Like you, I would never spend $1,000 for a voltmeter, because there are ways. If you can build a seismometer, I know you could build a voltmeter. I didn't say it's easy, but I know you could do it. It would be a fun project. But the thing that I've got, I wonder if you've ever seen anything like that on the surplus market, John. Over to you, K2LIW.
Oh, yes, I have, Dick. And I think you're right. It is traction. You're right. Otherwise, because I think the full potential is on those plates. So, therefore, I'm wondering about the traction and arc over. There has to be a voltage divider in there somewhere. And I was just going to mention, you may want to look into somebody who has the old Pomona probes for the high voltage. They'll handle 40 kV, and it'll give you the proper attenuation, I think, for that device. If not, you could probably make a series parallel arrangement to do it, and that'll give you a very accurate reading.
I own one of these very high voltage probes for an oscilloscope. The whole thing is about 2 feet long. And you're supposed to pour this special fluid into it to make sure it's got high internal insulation and no possibility of air arcing and whatever. However, although that thing can measure very high voltage, it is internally a resistive voltage divider network. And whether or not that thing has an internal impedance of 10 to the 11 or 10 to the 12 ohms, I'm very doubtful. Therefore, I'm afraid that that probe might create too much load. Current-wise, these machines you and I own are really flea power. I think on a really good day, they might be able to turn out 10 microamps. I think it really wants to run at 3 microamps or 2 microamps when it's making maximum voltage, maybe 1 microamp. So the thing really wants extremely high impedances as a load. And by the way, this Vane voltmeter of mine, Precision Dynamics or whatever the brand name is, when you look inside, you open up the box, this extremely high voltage porcelain insulator coming out the back has a rod going down the center. Depending on which voltage scale you're on, you determine how much of the rod pokes into the box. When you're at the highest voltage scale, the 30 kilovolt scale, the rod is poking into the diagonal corner of the box, the minimum amount. The end of the rod has a great big bulbous object, nice round object on it. That sits, I'm going to pick a number, 2 or 3 inches from the nearest vein. That vein is grounded. The electrostatic attraction to that vein is what moves the Dawson-Val meter movement. It's not really Dawson-Val meter. There's no magnet in there, but it looks like a Dawson-Val meter. It's got a watch spring, a multi-turn watch spring-like spring that is a restoring force. I don't think it's got any damping action to it. The air moving in the box is the damping action. And so what I think I can do is don't make direct contact to that high-voltage porcelain insulator thing on the outside. Just bring my voltage that I want to measure nearby. And by the way, electrostatic repulsion occurs. I think that'll give me the voltage divider function that I'm looking for. And therefore, as I determine the right distance externally as the air gap, as long as it doesn't arc over, and I don't think it will, I think I can get the voltage multiplication that I want. Other than that, the only other way I could multiply the machine is a resistor voltage divider on the outside, and I can't make the impedance high enough easily. Or to build the whole machine at four times normal size. It already is a cubic foot. I don't want to make a 4 foot cube just to be able to measure voltage. I never thought I would run into a problem where I can't build something big enough conveniently to measure the voltage that I want to see. Over to you, John, K2RIW.
Yeah, that's a great idea by using an air gap. And you could do that probably relatively easy because you know exactly how many millimeters apart you have your setting at. You can calculate, 30 kV per centimeter? So you should be able to do that fairly accurately, I would believe. You agree?
Absolutely. As long as I know the dimensions of the ball that's going to be on the end of the highly insulated probe that's on the voltmeter, the thing that I bring nearby is going to be another sized ball, and I know the spacing between the two, I can make a pretty good approximation. And by the way, one way I can calibrate it is to make direct contact, register 30 kilovolts, back it away until I see 15 kilovolts. Measure the distance that's required to do that. One of the experiments I did with the Van de Graaff generator is that with the Van de Graaff generator, I set up the voltmeter between the great big bowl on top of the Van de Graaff generator was one clip lead. The other clip lead went over to the bowl that went nearby, that's the grounded bowl. And I ran the machine very briefly until I got 30 kilovolts. Then I turned the machine off. I watched the voltage slowly decay. And I had, I'm guessing, a gap between the grounding bowl and the main bowl. I would guess I had a gap of about 2 or so inches. It didn't arc over. I waited until it slowly settled down to about 27 kilovolts. Then I picked up the grounded bowl and brought it further away from the big bowl of the Van de Graaff generator. What do you think the voltmeter did when I did that? Over to you, John, K2RIW.
I don't know, but I think you're going to tell me.
Yeah, because the two leads to the voltmeter, one lead was on the grounded bowl, one lead was on the hot bowl of the Van de Graaff generator. I ran the machine very briefly until it went to 30 kilovolts. I think it went to 35 and pegged the meter, and I waited until it settled down to about 26 kilovolts. And as I said, the gap between the two bowls was the 5-inch diameter bowl on top and the 4-inch diameter shorting bowl. I'm guessing the numbers, but I had a gap of about 2 or 3 inches between them. I then separated that by 2 or 3 times the distance, picked up the grounded one. I didn't want to touch the high voltage one. Picked up the grounded one and separated them. The 27 kilovolts went to 30 kilovolts. The voltage on the voltmeter increased, and that's exactly what's supposed to happen. Do you know the explanation on that one, John? Go ahead.
Well, somehow the impedance went down. Voltage went up. Don't know the answer.
You're getting very close. Impedance is almost it. It's really charge. Q, charge, in coulombs, equals CV. If somebody tells you the capacitance in farads and the voltage in volts on that capacitor, you know exactly how much charge there is in coulombs, how many electrons that are there, so to speak. And it can't be electrons. But we'll call it that for the time being. How much charge there is. There's a certain amount of capacitance between the shorting bowl and the main bowl of the Van de Graaff generator when they were sitting at 2 inches apart. When I increased them to 6 inches apart, the capacitance between the two decreased. If Q equals CV, and I didn't discharge anybody, so Q stayed the same. If C went down, V has to go up, so the product stays the same. Since total stored kinetic energy and stored electrostatic energy, is in joules, 1/2 CV squared, since the voltage went up and the C only changed a little bit, and you're squaring the voltage, the total energy went up when I did that. The voltage went from 27 kilovolts to 30 kilovolts. The capacitance went down a predictable amount by my extra separation. The charge stayed the same, but the energy, stored energy, went up. Where did the energy come from? I supplied it. Because there was a voltage difference between those two bowls, there was a certain electrostatic attraction between the two. There was an attractive force between them. When I picked up one of them and separated it, I was fighting that force. I was doing work. The work that I did increased the total energy of the system, increased the voltage, increased the energy, but the total amount of charge stayed the same. It would make a very nice science experiment in front of a classroom to demonstrate those principles, if you know what I mean. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
You know, you brought up a very interesting point with the Quinhurst machine. If you were to bring your high voltage meter and touch it on that probe, I don't think you'll develop any high voltage on that Quinhurst machine.
You might be right, but maybe not. If the wiring I use between the probe of the high voltage machine is the proper kind of high voltage wiring with no sharp spikes, see, when you put the piece of steel wool there, you had spark guides, sharp spikes all over the place, as opposed to the nice round stainless steel balls. the big ball and the little ball. Nice round balls have very little sharp points. And by the way, my Van de Graaff generator, there is some when I can't get it to go, or I can't get it to give very much voltage. All I've got to do is take an